Inside the Huddle with Sky Sports, Neil Reynolds and Jeff Rimbo.
Yes, hello. Welcome to Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. We're sponsored by Sport Lobster, the sports social network. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds. And I'm sad to say that my cohort, my co-host, my partner, Jeff Reinbold, is no longer sat in front of me, but he's back in North America. But we're going to talk more about Super Bowl 49. We're going to start to look at the NFL offseason. As Jeff always says, there is no offseason, and already it's been a busy week of news. But Jeff, just first of all, we'll get into the call from Pete Carroll, the way the game ended. Just as you've had time, a couple of days to reflect on it, it was a great Super Bowl, wasn't it?
The best ever. I think it's my, you know, I've heard people over here say it was the best game ever played. But if it wasn't the best game ever played, it had got to be one of the top four or five, because it was exciting from beginning to end. It had all the drama, all the big plays, all the big hits, the everything you could possibly want in a game.
Yeah, it did have everything, didn't it? The momentum changes, the lead changes, the shifts in who we thought was going to win this game. And really, it was, you know, we'll look at that call in a second, the Pete Carroll call, because that is what a lot of people are talking about. But I would recommend that everyone go to NFL.com and check out they've now put out, Jeff, the stuff where all the players are mic'd up for the Super Bowl. And, you know, it's broken into little segments, but it basically takes you inside the Super Bowl more than ever before. And I watched it today. First of all, the ending is like a Hollywood movie. I mean, you couldn't make some of it up. It was just ridiculously good. You've got the anxiety on the face of Richard Sherman. You've got Tom Brady jumping up and down just before he scores his touchdown. You've got Julian Edelman walking around the huddle for the Patriots, telling everyone that he loves them. I mean, it was almost too good to be true, but it's fantastic footage.
Well, you know, that's one of the great things about the National Football League, is they give the fans a true inside perspective of what goes on in the game. And, you know, like you see Edelman's response at the most critical time, when the most pressure on him, and what does he do? He reaches out and you know, he tells his teammates that he loves them. Mm. And it was interesting when Julian was being interviewed during the week, they asked him what his favorite Super Bowl moment has been. And he went to the John Candy comment that Joe Montana made to his teammates before the drive against Cincinnati, where he said, "Hey," pointed up in the stands, "this is the, you're getting ready for the final drive to win the game. Hey, isn't that John Candy?" Mm. And you know, it was, he's had his own John Candy moment now, I guess.
You do get great insight into the game. And I'll talk in a little while about the Seahawks in the second half. I wanted to highlight a couple of quotes and comments that they made as the game was going on. But there was a bit in the first half when Jeremy Lane intercepted Tom Brady, and straight away, Tom Brady and Josh McDaniels are having a conversation on the sideline saying Lane's out of the game. They're going to have to put somebody else in there. And sure enough, Jeff, we saw it. They went after Thowald Simon. I mean, this validates everything that we talk about, and we see it, but it backed it up there. If you lose a key player, the offense is going to go straight after that guy on defense.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, rather than feeling sorry for himself because he threw the interception, or, you know, his coach being upset with him because he threw the interception, they were right on to the next situation. Mm. And I think that's really one of the great things that you notice about the Patriots coaching staff, particularly, is that, you know, even in that last series when Seattle's coming down the field, McDaniels and Brady were on the sideline talking about what they would have to do if they needed another possession. Mm. So, again, great coaching and, you know, great awareness and being in the moment by those coaches.
I thought Belichick, you know, going into the last two drives that the Patriots had to make, he kind of gathered his troops on the sideline, and it was a good insight into coaching. And, it, you know, they talk about Belichick being an all-time great and a coaching genius, but what he actually said was, he didn't need to be a genius to say what he said. And he was telling his players, there are no new plays. There's no mystery here, fellas. He said, you just got to do your job. And it was interesting, because it was, you know, it wasn't trying to overcomplicate it. It was just, he did give some technical advice, you know, do this, wrap up Marshawn Lynch, make sure you play better man coverage on defense. But the message overall was, if you trust your job and do your job, even in this biggest stage, even though it doesn't look like, you know, you're in a position to win at the moment, you can still win this game.
Well, that's their mantra. And it was, again, interesting. The little things you pick up at the Super Bowl when you go to the press conferences and all that. I saw a number of Patriot players walking around with what they call toques here in Canada, stocking caps in America. I don't even know what they call them in the United Kingdom. But the with the Patriot logo on it and then stitched into the stocking cap was do your job. Mm. And, again, that's what's one of the reasons why they're so successful. Guys don't play outside the scheme. They don't play outside their responsibility. And they do their job. It's a great lesson for, for everybody in any walk of life.
In the second half, Jeff, Seattle went up 24-14. And a couple of the quotes on this inside the game stuff. Jermaine Kearse started talking about Chris Matthews potentially being MVP. Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson were hugging and saying, ain't this something? And Richard Sherman said his heart is almost gone in reference to Tom Brady. I mean, I'm sure they carried on playing hard. We know they did. They were in a position to win this game. But, there was a feeling there, I think, among Seattle as they took control, as we probably felt at the time. It felt like Seattle were taking over that game. It looks like those Seahawks players and coaches felt they were as well.
Yeah, there was a time in that game, certainly when all the momentum was on Seattle's side. But really premature to say, you've almost taken away all this. You're not going to do that to a great competitor like Tom Brady. He's going to battle you to the very last minute, to the very last play. And again, that's how he proved that to be the case. I don't know if you saw this over there, but there was a picture here of Edelman at the parade yesterday in New England.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a big placard that was a picture of Richard Sherman, and Richard Sherman was mocking the Patriots when they got to 24 points, and he was into the television camera making a 2 and a 4 sign with his hands, 24 points, 24 points. Mm. And Edelman had the placard, this big poster on a stick, and it was a picture of Sherman with his, his four fingers stuck up, and he had superimposed on it. How many Super Bowl rings does Tom Brady have?
It was Sherman
showing four. So I thought that was kind of clever.
See, I don't know if Sherman was saying 24 points or if he was taking a shot. You can read this either way, taking a shot at Darrelle Revis, who wears number 24, because he was beaten on the play by Doug Baldwin. Either way, Sherman was sticking it to the Patriots. But, Jeff, at the end of this inside the game stuff, Brady's on one knee as the clock's ticking down. Who's the first person in front of him offering his hand to shake it was Richard Sherman. I actually thought, Sherman, who's been, very exuberant whenever he's won, I thought he showed some class there in the face of defeat.
Yeah, I was glad he did that. I really was proud of him for that moment. Mm. And the way he handled himself, all that stuff was going on. Well, those two were on the ground. Mm. Like Brady was on his knee and Richard Sherman was shaking his hand. About everybody else on the field was in a brawl in the end zone.
Yes.
And those two guys stayed clear of all that stuff and stayed above all the emotion in that moment. And, again, it was I give Richard Sherman, we're really so quick to criticize him because of his arrogance and his, how he handles himself. But, I think we've got to be just as quick to praise him when he does it the right way.
Let's have a look at the call at the end of the game then, Jeff, because we talked about this outside the stadium immediately after the game. And I want to more look at the reaction that's come off the back of it. You mentioned on air at the time that, it's going to be difficult for Pete Carroll to go into that locker room and face those players and, kind of explain what you did, why you didn't run it on second and goal from the 1 yard line. And I think what's happened here, Pete Carroll, to his credit, okay, I watched this straight afterwards. Pete Carroll has come out and he has fronted up big time with the media. But I think, I've never seen a coach do so many one-on-one interviews with all the major networks. There was a one-on-one interview. Then he's texting Michael Silver of NFL.com late into the night explaining his call. I think this was such a monumentally bad call on such a big stage that's why he's felt like he had to explain it. Because it's going to go down as one of the strangest calls in pro football history. And I think that's why the coach came out and tried to explain it as much as he did. What your thoughts on how he handled all that? And then I want to ask you one other question about it.
Well, I think I really think that you're exactly right. I think the why this it's caused Pete to spend so much time trying to justify it or rationalize it or explain it is that it is such a bizarre call in that time. Now, it's interesting to me, on the other hand, that you've heard Belichick come out and say that he understood why he made that call. Mm. I've heard all of the different rationales, you know, that the Patriots were in goal line defense and they had three receivers on the field, so they thought they would have a numerical advantage and get linebackers. But what really happened was the Patriots were in a goal line defense, but they had three corners in their goal line defense, which is unusual, but you know, that's on Seattle's coaches to recognize that.
Mm.
So if they truly thought they were in goal line defense with no corners on the field, then it makes the call make sense. But even at that, it's a mistake because, you know, they had their goal line personnel with three corners, which is an unusual setup. But, you know, you got to recognize that from the booth. It's still going to be – it's one of these ones we're going to talk about for a long, long, long time.
Mm. This is the bit I don't get, Jeff. And, if Pete Carroll is going to come out and say, they were in goal line, we felt we had the best – the best situation to pass the football there. And actually, you're right, because what happened was, and you see it on this Inside the Game stuff, New England hurry on a third corner, and Pete Carroll didn't spot that or didn't see that. So, you know, the perfect situation he thought he had, he didn't actually have. But he said in his explanation, really on second down, we were trying to waste a down, and then we were going to win it on third or fourth down, and we could have run the football there. Mike, I think that's where he's then... I think there you're actually not making any sense, because I think that if you're going to waste a down, a pass into the end zone doesn't run off that much time on the clock. If you're actually truly going to waste a down, you ask Russell Wilson to take a knee there.
Yeah, you waste a down by again, as you say, by running the football, taking a knee, doing something to... continue the clock, because the clock, otherwise, if it's incomplete, even if you throw it over his head and it's incomplete, the clock stops. So you're not gaining the advantage of wasting a down. So again, it's almost like you say to Pete, okay, Pete, that's enough. Don't try and over explain it, because you're just digging a hole deeper, it's like when you were a little kid and you got in trouble and you tried to explain to your mother what you'd done. And the more you talk, the bigger hole you dug. So I think that's kind of the situation that he's in right now. And, you know, it's not going to go away. It'll be something that they'll talk about over and over and over again. And all the talk shows here were just, exploding with it. Yesterday, I'm flying on a plane from Vancouver to Toronto, and he's a really, really popular talk show host here in Sports Talk. And, it's just like 15 minutes he spent on that one call. And I think that's going to be That's going to be one of the legacies of this game.
Daryl Bevel made a comment after the game. I remember reading this sitting on the bus as we were heading back to our hotel after the game, and things were coming through on Twitter. And Daryl Bevel said that he thought Ricardo Lockett could have been stronger on the play. And I thought, oh boy, you probably are correct if you're going to make a pure coaching point, but it just felt like that wasn't the time to be. But, talking about a player not quite getting himself into the right position with all the attention that was on the call. And, Doug Baldwin afterwards expressed disappointment at Daryl Bevel for that. And again, that goes back to that sort of building of bridges that might need to be done in Seattle. I know that Bruce Irvin was very outspoken afterwards. Michael Bennett was outspoken afterwards. Marshawn Lynch actually didn't say very much. And you see him on the field in the Inside the Game stuff, kind of running off laughing almost, I think in disbelief that he didn't get it. But, Bevel, what do you make of Bevel, calling out Ricardo Lockett there?
I just think that's really unfortunate. I think that was probably an emotional thing. You just lost the Super Bowl because of a really questionable call.
Mm.
And again, I think human nature is you're going to try and rationalize that or justify it or spread the blame or whatever. The reality of it is you just don't call out your players. And that's, so critical in these moments, because there's going to be finger pointing anyway. And the less of it you do, the better. You've got to control your own emotions as a coach. And, I think that's really an unfortunate situation.
there was some emotion there after the game. And, yeah, we can talk about this a little bit. I mean, you may not want to because he's a friend of yours. But Michael Bennett turned on the media, Jeff. At one point, he asked, he said to one guy, you know, I don't have to take this from you. All you've ever done is pick up a microphone. And then another guy for NFL.com, I'll be careful how I word this. He said, I was as shocked as your wife when she first saw your, you know what. I mean, it was stuff that you didn't need to be saying. And actually, extending it past that, Bill Belichick came out this week and said that people are not qualified to comment on the Seattle Seahawks play call. I would take umbrage with that. I mean, I've never been a chef, but I know what a burnt chip tastes like. That wasn't that complicated a thing. If you started talking to me about five different kinds of coverages, along the way you would lose me. But on second and goal from the one with Marshawn Lynch in the backfield, I know what a run looks like and I know what a pass that's dangerous looks like. From the Seahawks' point of view, there was probably too much emotion there straight after the game. And that must have killed them, mustn't it?
I think it's that really touchy situation where those guys are playing for the world championship. Mm. And something that they've fought and scratched and clawed for, and you get very few chances in your life. And, did Michael handle himself correctly in that situation? Absolutely not. But
would we have all done the same? We might have done the same.
Yeah, I can understand to a certain degree when you're all of us. That's where that cooling off period is so important. And
I agree.
You know, obviously, I would be willing to bet you that that was a very, very emotional locker room after the game, and that there, you know, I'm sure there were questions asked.
Yep.
In that locker room, in frustration, in the pain of the moment, because those guys, just lost a game that they should have won. Mm-hmm. Frankly, had an opportunity to win a game. You're at the 1 yard line with three chances and 40 seconds left to go in the game, and you got the best running back in football, and you make a decision to take the ball off the line of scrimmage and throw it, and it gets picked, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, Jeff. I mean, we've all said things in the heat of, playing games in the British League, and then said things where you think, why did you say that? You know, and this is the Super Bowl. You know, he's just lost the Super Bowl. We're talking minutes. It doesn't even compare. But, I mean, we all get caught up in games that we play, and emotion would be running wild there for them.
Yeah. And, they're an emotional team anyway.
Yes.
And that's, they're a team that tells you what's on their mind, and I was not surprised. As a matter of fact, I was not surprised that there weren't some sort of physical altercation in the locker room, because I've seen that happen in those scenarios where you lose a game in that kind of situation.
Tom Brady was outstanding. He got the game's MVP, Jeff, but just he did pick on a secondary that now turns out was really banged up, because Jeremy Lane went down with the broken wrist. Richard Sherman looks like he might have Tommy John surgery, which is like all the ligaments, isn't it, in your elbow. Earl Thomas was still carrying the shoulder injury. And Cam Chancellor, it turns out, had a bone bruise and a torn MCL. He'd been told 2 days before the Super Bowl. And it was funny because it was all sort of played down, and the Seahawks did a great job of keeping a lid on that. It was just old Cam's injured his knee, but, he was walking off fine. Well, it turns out he had a torn MCL, and he makes 10 tackles in the Super Bowl. So it was a secondary that Brady was able to pick on in the end.
Yeah, and, that's, again, a credit to those athletes. And you recognize how important that game is. Anybody that has had a torn MCL recognizes how difficult it is just for the stability of your knee, and then on top of it, all the pain every time you plant and drive, which is what a DB has to do on every play in a game. So those guys went out there, and there were heroic efforts on both sides, but certainly those Seattle kids playing hurt and doing, playing against a great quarterback like Tom Brady. That's why yesterday I heard another talk show guy talk about how Brady ripped that secondary apart. I just don't, first of all, it was the linebackers and the undercoverage he ripped apart more than anything, not the corners. But, again, that's what they're going to have to live with now for, another 7 months in this offseason until they can get back to work and try and right the wrong.
Mm. It may not have been passes 20 or 30 yards downfield. I mean, we know that was looking at that number, that stat we often use. Only two players had worse worse percentages on passes over 20 yards in the season than Tom Brady, but it was short passes. He was shredding them, and he was on the money. Jeff, you'd always talk about, you know, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. Think about the pressure and the stage that that Super Bowl on. It was pandemonium down there on the field. Brady's final two possessions, he goes 13 of 15, 121 yards, two touchdowns, no interceptions. That's why we're talking an all-time great.
Yeah, and the way he did it, too, there were a number of times in those drives where he had to go to secondary receivers. He had to shuffle up in the pocket. He had to, you know, he threw off of, you know, what we call a poor throwing platform. You know, his feet were not where they wanted to be. But yet still, he was able to put the ball right on guys. You know, and I think there are two guys that really, in that fourth quarter, that really stood out to me. And first of all was Brady, as you mentioned, just how laser sharp he was and how accurate he was. And then Julian Edelman just competed his heart out in the fourth quarter.
How tough is he? It's so tough. Jeff, let's take a couple of the mailbag questions now because they relate to this game and this finish. This is a good question from Ben, who said, why did Russell Wilson listen to Pete Carroll's call? Would other quarterbacks, Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, have gone over the coach's head? That's a big ask, isn't it, inside the final minute of the Super Bowl? What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I think they did. I'm sure they did communicate. I'm sure there was some talk on the, you know, in that last drive, what exactly what they were going to do and what their approach was going to be. And you know, in terms of the quarterback changing the call or aborting the call, you know, I just don't think the way that they're set up. And, you know, even a guy like Aaron Rodgers, I'm sure, he may ask Mike about, hey, are you sure that's what you want to do? I cannot see him changing that play or, you know, getting out of that play in that scenario. There are very few players that at the quarterback position, Peyton Manning probably being one, who could, you know, abort the call at that point.
Jeff, my dad's been a long-time NFL fan. He actually got me into the sport, and he's got this... he doesn't actually necessarily overthink things when he's giving his analysis. I was driving back from the airport once I landed here in the UK, and my dad just went, well, he didn't want to make Marshawn Lynch the star. He wanted to give Russell Wilson all the glory. It can't have been so simple, surely.
Your dad's a conspiracy theorist,
yes,
huh?
Yes, he is. And this one from Jim, who says, it does. I don't know if you've got anything to add to what you said, but Jim says, how can Darrell Bevell have the respect of the Seahawks players after the call and then after throwing Lockett under the bus? I mean, anything else to add there? I know you've spoken about Bevell. And
I agree with that. I agree with that statement. I think it's going to be really tough. He's going to have to go back in now in this offseason. There's a lot of wounds that are going to have to be healed. But the great thing about being in a competitive sport like this is that once you do start to compete again, that stuff tends to be forgotten as long as you know, I'm sure he'll apologize to those guys and he'll probably apologize, you know, to the team in as a whole and maybe even publicly come out and say, you know, I should have rethought that comment. But once they get back together and they're in the OTAs and mini camp and all that stuff, you know, that those wounds will really start to heal.
Talking of wounds healing, we mentioned Sherman's probably going to have an operation. He was going to wait until his baby boy was born. His son has now been born, so they'll take a look at that. I assume Cam Chancellor will have some kind of surgery. Jeremy Lain is going to have some surgery. So, Jeff, let's now sort of transition away from this Super Bowl and into the off season, and that's going to be tough on those injured players. I've got a question in a second in the mailbag asking what players get up to in the first few weeks of the off season. And whether they're allowed time off. But first of all, you know, it's been a long season. This is the time to now enjoy yourself and have a rest. If you get injured in the last game of the year, that's a miserable start to your off season, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because what you want to be able to do now is take about 3 weeks and just get away from everything. Get away from football, get away from the meeting room, get away from the weight room, and just get your body healed up and your mind recharged, and then you'll start over again. But you know, for those guys that are surgical, you know, they'll go in for the, you know, they'll get in and get them worked on as fast as they can because they need that time for their rehab and to heal from those things. You know, those are all injuries that, you know, that are certainly you can recover from, but every week that you have another week before the season starts, it's another week that body can heal, and that surgical, you know, whether it's the Tommy John thing for Richard Sherman or a repair an MCL, that those tendons and ligaments, you know, have a chance to set before you put them under the stress of another season.
Yeah, this question, actually, you've touched on a lot of it there, but it was from The Ugly Game. He said, in the first few weeks of the off-season, are players allowed time off from eating right and exercise? And I spoke to Menelik Watson, the British offensive tackle of the Oakland Raiders. We got together just before the Super Bowl, before I flew out to Phoenix, and he was saying, you know, the first month after the season is get your body healed. You know, he said the first couple of weeks, he said he almost didn't move. You know, he was in his apartment. And I guess, if you're looking long term, Jeff, you have to take some of that time to. There's such a physical pounding, isn't there, on the body that's not being lazy, that's being sensible.
No, it is being sensible because you are just really beat up. I mean, it's hard for anybody who's never witnessed it or gone through it to understand just what a stress that puts on your body. The pounding day to day, the practices, all that, you know, for the big guys especially, that it's ridiculous, you know, what they do to their bodies. And so, like Menelik says, you need that time just to let the tissues heal and you know, all of it start to come back. Now, what you have to be careful of when you're a big kid is you got to be careful that you don't eat your way into a bigger problem. Mm. And, you know, all of a sudden now you come back and you're 40 or 50 pounds overweight, and you got to work through that. So, you know, if I was speaking to Menelik, what I would say to him is, hey, take the time, let your body heal, but be really careful that you don't, you know, just let everything go, and now all of a sudden you're trying to deal with a weight loss issue and, you know, get yourself ready for a season.
One man who has had his rest and is already back to work, I saw this story around the Super Bowl, was J.J. Watt, who we're both big fans of. He's bought himself a log cabin up in the woods of Wisconsin, Jeff, and he's going to go up there and work out. I'm thinking Rocky Balboa in Rocky IV, where he's carving the logs and he's, you know, he's lifting up horses on carts. It's fantastic stuff. Go on, J.J.
He's a beautiful thing, isn't he? I think
he's
took 15 minutes out of the Pro Bowl, and that's how long he took. I mean, he's back at it.
He hasn't taken long off. Let's have a look at some news then. I'm going to start with the Cleveland Browns, and I thought about this. Browns fans, they must be like, what the heck is going on? So you've got Josh Gordon has now been suspended for at least a year. At least a year is the key phrase there, because he's going to have to undergo 10 drug tests per year, pass all of those to even be considered for reinstatement into the NFL. Johnny Manziel has checked himself into rehab. That happened on the Wednesday before Super Bowl. Offensive coordinator Kyle Shanahan wanted out of town. He's gone. The team is being investigated for team officials apparently texting coaches suggesting plays during the game. That could cost the team draft picks. And now Pro Bowl tight end Jordan Cameron, who is a free agent, has said that he's got no interest in returning. Where should we start? Let's start with Johnny Football, Jeff.
Well, I'm hopeful. You know, Anytime you see a situation like this where a young athlete has gotten himself in a scenario where just out of control, and, you know, first step to getting that fixed is to admit you have a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, admission that, you know, I've got an issue with alcohol. I've got to get myself cleaned up. And hopefully the situation in rehab will be the start of him, you know, becoming the player that everybody thought he could be when, you know, he was such a dynamic collegiate player and was drafted in, you know, five rounds. So I think, you know, again, in Johnny Manziel's case, I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I think what I would add to that is that, you know, I think it looks like he hasn't had the best of people around him advising him, because he came into the NFL where he's had success early in college without probably having to be the kind of worker bee that Peyton Manning is or Tom Brady is. And so he's got by, and you can't get by in the NFL, but he doesn't look like he had the right people around him to tell him that. Now he's taken control himself. He's taken ownership of this problem, and, you know, you hope he gets it fixed. I would say, you know, before Browns fans are thinking this is the end of the road for Johnny Manziel and what a wasted draft pick, you know, Brett Favre was in rehab, Jeff, for painkiller addiction, you know, before he went on to win the Super Bowl with the Green Bay Packers. So he can fight his way back from this.
Yeah, I mean, he won't be the first guy that has come back from something like this. But again, I would be really cautionary about this because, you know, this is a difficult, difficult situation. And, you know, I don't know the extent of his issue, but certainly when you're 23 years old and you're putting yourself in rehab, you've got a problem. And, you know, until he gets the problem fixed, he's going to have a very difficult time being the player that you know, the fans expect him to be and certainly that he expects himself to be. And, you know, like you say, Neil, this is why yesterday was National Signing Day here in the United States. And for the UK fans, that's when these young high school kids can first sign a letter of intent on where they're going to go to college. And what this has turned into now is, you know, kids are having press conferences and, you know, they put on one hat and take it off, and then they put on another hat and
They
take that off and they put on. It's just a circus. It's a circus. And it's the start of kids having that sense of entitlement that Johnny Manziel came into the league with, that, you know, I don't have to work. I was drafted in the first round. I've made it, right? And it was really interesting. I heard Damian Woody, the old Patriot guard, talking about it yesterday, and he said, who do these kids think they are? They haven't done anything, and they're holding press conferences? But that's just how crazy this whole thing is over here with college football.
You want to talk about a vicious circle or a catch-22. It's, you know, the media has such a passion and interest in, and a financial interest in promoting the sport that they encourage those kind of press conferences where I've seen it where all the hats are lined up and then he picks one out and that's where he's going. But then we will absolutely crucify a guy when they get to the NFL and they're too big for their boots. But we started the process as they were coming out of high school. It's media driven out of high school. They go all this way up.
Well, they're 17-year-old kids, you know. And like you say, it's media driven because it's fan driven. The fans want to know, right? And when you've got 100,000 people or 110,000 people at Michigan coming to see these 18 and 19-year-old kids, well, they want to know what the next crop is. And so what does that do? It's a really an interesting vicious circle, but the kids have to somewhere, somehow we have to get them to understand that you're setting yourself up for failure down the road. Interesting, was it not, that there was not a single five-star player. A five-star player is as high as those recruiting services can rate a player.
Okay.
There was not a single five-star player starting in the NFL in the Super Bowl. Not one.
Was that true? Really? So they
there
is so
not one five-star player. There was not one five-star player in the starting lineup in the Super Bowl. Not a one.
That is pretty telling. And it was interesting. There were some quotes from J.J. Watt yesterday about signing day. Not using Jay, but it's just he's a good example because he's a success, a huge success in the NFL. And he was saying it doesn't matter what school they go to, you know, how many star students you sign, it's about how hard you work. This game still comes down to how hard you work. And that's why I guess you got Jimmy Devlin on the Patriots roster. He was a defensive end at Brown University. And you've got Julian Edelman. You've got all these sort of guys that come different ways, don't they, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, you know, J.J. Watt was a walk-on. He wasn't even on scholarship when he went to Wisconsin. He was delivering pizzas.
That's
right?
Incredible.
He wasn't holding press conferences to say, hey, I'm taking three pepperonis to Maple Street, right? I mean, come on, man. You got to be kidding me.
It must be hard. It's going to be hard for players going forward because this media attention is not going away. So, you know, the interest in the game is at an all-time high. If you're seeing high school students hold those kind of press conferences, and then you get the opposite end of it where Michael Bennett has a microphone under his nose that within seconds of you know, losing the Super Bowl, this must be the environment that these players in this day and age operate in compared to, I don't know, even Johnny Unitas, who was an all-time great, probably wasn't. You know, I watched Joe Namath's Football Life, Jeff, on the morning of the Super Bowl, the night before the Super Bowl, and he was holding his press conference sitting in his swimming shorts next to the swimming pool, and there are a couple of guys around him. I mean, it's a world away. So these young players today, huge challenges for them in the coming years.
Yeah, and again, I think that puts an onus on all the coaches that deal with these kids and the academic advisors and the player development people, and everybody's got to help these kids understand that, it's just like J.J. Watt said, it's about what you do on game day and what you do to prepare, for game day. Mm. And so many of these kids just don't get it, and then they lose their opportunity. So many of them could have been great players, but because they got so wrapped up in all of this hype and all of this, here's the reality. For all these kids holding press conferences, they're going to walk onto campus in the summer, and they're going to be one of 95 football players. Mm. And all of a sudden, it's where's all the bright lights and where's the microphones, and I'm a freshman, and I'm the fourth team tailback, and, they're set up for failure.
Let's get into the mailbag then, Jeff. Take a couple of questions before we finish off. Steve actually says, could you give a shout-out to the Worcestershire Black Knights? A new team being set up for 2015. There you go, Steve, and good luck to the Black Knights in their debut season. This one from Tom Marshall. He says, now that he has a Super Bowl ring, do you think that Darrell Revis stays with New England or does he cash in with another team? So, Jeff, here are the financials. Revis was paid around $12 million this year by the New England Patriots. That is due to go up. They still own his rights. That goes up to $20 million in 2015. The top end of the market is Richard Sherman, around $12 million per year. So Revis has been one of these guys. I mean, a lot was made of it during Super Bowl week. He's earned around about $84, $85 million in his career. He's always been looked at as a bit of a sort of mercenary for hire, if you will. I mean, what do you think now? Has he found his home?
Well, it's interesting. I know the Patriots will certainly try and keep him, but, the Patriots have never been shy about getting rid of guys either. I mean, you look at Richard Seymour and all the way, there's a long history of it. Mm. When guys start to make too much money for them to upset their balance. It's interesting. Here in Buffalo, there's a lot of talk about Rex bringing Revis to Buffalo.
Uh-huh.
And
that, he loved
trying
Revis,
to reunite them that way. And that is the one little area in that defense, that one chink in the armor of that defense. If they could get a lockdown corner, they would really be special on defense here in Buffalo. And again, there's a lot of speculation and talk about that here in Buffalo.
Oh, that'd be interesting because, Revis now, you could argue, has his Super Bowl ring. He has that part of his career box checked. And, nobody begrudges him the chance to earn the money, because we know that players can be sort of cut and moved on, and the league moves on without them. So you make your money when you can. I mean, I guess the thing, I don't think New England are going to pay him $20 million either. And if they look to try and pay him around 12, I could imagine that a team like Buffalo or somebody else will say, okay, we'll give you 14 or 15. So then it's, can New England get a long-term deal? Because he can clearly still play and he's a good fit for their system. But they won't. You're right, Belichick, they don't want to break the bank completely, do they?
No, they don't want to upset the balance in their locker room. They do a great job, probably as good a job as anybody, of recognizing when to give and when to take and, who to cut and who to move and who to sign. Certainly you look at a guy like Brandon Browner, who has a reputation, even when he was up here in the CFL, reputation for being a hard guy to be around, tough in the locker room, issues off the field, all that. That doesn't sound like a guy that, would fit in New England, but just like Randy Moss did for a while, they'll take a guy like that, and they know when he's, past his welcome. And I'm sure they're going to do the same thing when they look at Revis's contract. Can we deal with whatever his demands are going to be, or whatever the balloon in that contract is going to be? And if we can, then we'll keep him. If we can't, we'll just move on, and they'll go on to plan B. Because I'm sure there is a plan B. They always have one.
Plan B is Malcolm Butler of the West Alabama Tigers, the star of the Super Bowl. I mean, we talk about the call, Jeff, but what a great defensive play that was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a phenomenal play because he had the trigger on that play. He obviously saw the play come, right? They're trying to pick, and, he came over the top of the pick and really drove the ball hard. And that takes great. I mean, you think about the confidence that takes by a young player, an undrafted free agent, in that biggest of moments, on that biggest of stages to drive on that ball as hard as he drove on that ball, and no hesitation, no, oh my gosh, it's too big for me. It was just, he just went and made a play. It was a phenomenal play.
He just did his job. Let's have this one from Richard Law. This will finish us off, Jeff. He says, when does the preseason schedule get announced? I'm in the US this summer and would love to go a game. So the regular season schedule gets announced mid-April. Mid to late April is when they will announce the regular season games. I think it's flexible, but I think it's normally mid to late May or early June. So it'll be sort of late spring that the preseason game schedule will be announced. And then what happens then is it's even later than you'll know who's playing who in what week. And then right near the end, the teams will say, well, okay, we're going to play on a Thursday night or a Friday night. So you're going to have to wait a little while for that, Richard. But there you go, Jeff. Our fans are already looking forward to 2015, as are we, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know what? I enjoy the preseason. I really, really do, because that's where, even though the football is probably not as good because, you know, it's a little raggedy because those guys haven't played together and those things, but that's where you see those Malcolm Butlers start to, you know, show themselves. Mm. The first glimmer of that guy that, you know, nobody talked about, the Cole Beasleys, the, you know, free agent guys that make a huge impact.
Chris Matthews.
And all of those guys, you know. So that to me is why I love preseason. I watch every preseason game I can get my hand. I watch any football game. It doesn't matter. But, you know, certainly NFL preseason games were big to me.
Good stuff, Jeff. That's us finished for this week's Inside the Huddle. Jeff, we'll come back next week. There is no off-season, and we'll start our state of the franchises. They're always good to dig into the teams, although the first few will go in draft order. So the first few that we talk about, they've just come off some pretty long years.
Well, they've got the toughest off-seasons, I think, because they've got the shortest off-season, and they've got the most guys that now want more money, want to take the bows, want to do all that. But certainly those are the best off seasons too, because you are a champion.
All right, good stuff. Jeff, this studio is big without you in it, man. Missing you. Missing you. Come back, Jeff.
I miss you. Miss you. Hey, it was great to see all the fans start talking about 2 and 3 podcasts. Keep that pressure on Nick Pike. Don't give him an in.
We'll keep on Nick Pike. But until then, we'll be back next week. Thanks, Jeff. There's Jeff Reinbold. This has been Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. It's a USP content production. We're sponsored by Sport Lobster, the sports social network. I don't know if he's still there to say goodbye, Jeff.
Aloha.